This episode of Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. When we consider what we're up against in tackling climate change, we often think about extreme weather, storms or heat or flooding, and all the effects on the infrastructure. We worry about wildfires in the West burning down our homes, hurricanes ripping through power lines, smog polluting the cities. But there's another side to this story, one that doesn't get as much of the spotlight, but one that is tremendously important. Our basic health, from how we feel after a long run to our ability to ward off illness, the environment makes a huge difference. Climate disruption invades our neighborhoods, and some are hit harder than others. Poor air quality results in unsafe living conditions and can lead to illnesses like asthma or even cancer. Extreme heat makes it hard for kids to play outside. Flooding and wildfires spread debris and bacteria. Warmer temperatures prompt insects to migrate north, carrying infectious diseases to new terrain. And sadly, that's only the beginning.
People die at high rates during heat waves, but also lots of things you wouldn't necessarily think of: increasing levels of violence during heat waves, increasing levels of suicide, decreased sleep quality, decreased academic performance, increased rates of workplace injuries, decreased productivity among workers, increased levels of kidney disease.
That day when they cut down the trees, it was still warm. It felt like the temperature immediately rose when those trees came down. Those people playing on the turf are subject to temperatures that are, 10, 15, even 20 degrees hotter than the air temperature.
Climate change is going to push us into temperatures which simply aren't survivable and which the infrastructure has no way of coping with.
You're listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. Today, we're talking about health and a changing climate. The way we feel, even the way we eat, soon may change. But there are ways that we can protect ourselves and our families from unknown variables that come with the evolving weather. Weather has always affected our moods and the choices that we make every day. I check the forecast on my phone several times a day. Then again, that could just be me. But when winter comes, we expect colds and flus to follow. We cuddle up inside to prevent more serious consequences, like exposure or frostbite, for instance. Many people experience seasonal affective disorder, and they are temporarily depressed during specific times of the year. In the summer, things change. We hydrate more to balance the impacts of rising heat and humidity. We cling to the shade of a sprawling oak tree. We seek respite in an air-conditioned living room sometimes when the sun gets just too hot. This is all common behavior, and we know about the seasons and the places where we live. For some reason, though, it doesn't always occur to us that climate change is making these conditions more pronounced. And add a new portfolio of health risks to that, and we've got something to think about here. Flu season could extend beyond what it normally does. Other illnesses could be brought into the mix. Those hot July days may be too hot to handle outdoors. The Centers for Disease Control report that extreme heat and air pollution have major effects on cardiovascular health, and extreme weather events increase the risk for respiratory diseases, injuries, and even premature death. There are threats to mental health and a greater prevalence of food and waterborne illnesses and other infectious diseases. Conditions like Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and malaria, for instance, are often carried by ticks, mosquitoes, and other bugs that cling to warmer temperatures. And because of the climate crisis, more places are going to get warmer. For children and young people whose bodies are still developing, climate disruption poses an even greater threat. An article in the New York Times stated, "Wildfire smoke in California, is poisoning children. That was the headline for a lengthy article about lung damage and lifelong health problems associated with air pollution from fires. The exhaust presents additional complications for people suffering from asthma, heart disease, and stroke. And there's been research that suggests that air pollution increases a person's risk for dementia. And of course, historically neglected communities suffer the most. People of color are at a higher risk from extreme events because of where they live. Black people are 30% more likely to die of heart disease than white people. Hispanic people are more likely to have risk factors for heart disease, such as obesity and diabetes. And Indigenous people are more likely to be obese and have high blood pressure. I spoke with Howard Frumkin, Senior Vice President with the Trust for Public Land and a professor at the University of Washington School of Public Health, where he researches this specific subject. Howard and I have worked together in the past, and I'll tell you, he's a master at breaking down complicated subjects. Howard shared his thoughts on why this topic often gets left out of the climate discussion.
When you think about mitigation, you think about reducing the carbon emissions that come from energy and from transportation and from buildings and so on. And that takes you down the path, if you're an engineer who's figuring out solutions, of shifting sources of electricity, of changing transportation patterns, and so on. Very rarely does health get factored into that thinking. You think about building seawalls and that sort of thing without necessarily factoring in health. So part of the realization is that these really are health matters, not exclusively health matters, but they're very much health matters. And that means that if we're going to mitigate climate change successfully, we better do it in ways that protect and promote health. And the same with adaptation.
Howard lists a number of ways the climate has the potential to damage our health. There are the direct effects of heat and severe weather events, such as decreased air quality and vector-borne illness. There are consequences that come with displacement from our homes due to sea level rise or hurricanes and fires. There are security issues, like our ability to cope with other large-scale problems, such as the COVID pandemic. And none of these issues are cut and dried.
People die at high rates during heat waves, but also lots of things you wouldn't necessarily think of: increasing levels of violence during heat waves, increasing levels of suicide, decreased sleep quality, decreased academic performance, increased rates of workplace injuries, decreased productivity among workers, increased levels of kidney disease. In addition to that, once you have climate change going and you have warmer weather, that increases the formation of ozone, all things being equal. So climate change decreases air quality, and that is bad for cardiac and respiratory health. Related to that, you have higher levels of allergen exposure because climate change spans the allergy season. Then you get to the question of displacement. Just looking within the U.S., Miami, New Orleans, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Las Vegas, these are all cities at high risk. And if we see migration out of those places, there isn't a single city in the country that's prepared to accept large numbers of in-migrants in terms of housing and transportation and jobs and schools and so on. We've only seen the tip of the iceberg so far, but that's been enough to upend politics, both in Europe and in North America, and to trigger the rise of autocracies and populist governments and anti-immigrant sentiment. And all of that, of course, has negative impacts on health and well-being of the people who are affected.
Plus, consider what we eat. We've mentioned the disruption to agriculture already. This, in turn, has consequences for our nutrition. Climate change endangers the safety of food and water supplies. It limits output and could put a halt on food production.
Productivity falls in many places. Let's acknowledge it'll rise in some places like Canada and Siberia. But in much of the world, food production will decrease. And not only that, the nutritional value of many foods declines under circumstances of high carbon dioxide. There's a growing body of evidence showing that protein content and some micronutrient content drop when you grow crops under conditions of high carbon dioxide. Add to all of that the increased growth of weeds, the disruption of storms, and we're going to see real disruptions to the food supply. We've seen them already. So our food system really isn't functioning well in many ways. We are producing very large amounts of hyper-processed food, and we are eating very large amounts of animal protein. And both of those things aren't the best health strategy, nor are they the best environmental strategy. So those are kind of baseline problems.
The fact that agricultural productivity is already down doesn't bode well for the millions of people around the world struggling with food insecurity. During COVID, some studies found that as many as 1 in 4 Americans didn't have enough to eat. But the thing is, there's food to go around, we're just wasting it. Over 30% of food goes uneaten and thrown into landfills in the United States. And there, it just further contributes to environmental problems.
Something like 15 to 20% of the U.S. population is food insecure, as defined by the Department of Agriculture. That means people who can't afford reliably putting food on the table. And when people who are food insecure become more stressed economically by rising food prices, then they shift toward high-calorie, low-nutrient foods. These are the ultra-processed foods that are bad for health. So we know that as food prices rise with scarcity, then the nutrient value of what people eat will decline. Long-term, we'll be seeing very large swaths of the world's population living in places that can't supply them with enough food. And that has huge implications for migration and for health and well-being. We need to shift away from animal protein toward eating more plants. Now, that's a controversial claim, but it's very, very well supported by evidence. Producing a pound of beef is very resource intensive in terms of water and land. This is part of the reason that the food system is such a major contributor to climate change. It's also the case that we waste about 30% of food produced globally. In poor places, the waste happens closer to the point of production because you can't store foods and ship them to market quickly enough. In wealthy places like the U.S., a lot of that waste takes place at the consumer end of the supply chain. So we all are familiar with having lots of food in our fridge that goes bad because we're not paying close enough attention to it. That needs to shift. We need much more care and less waste in the way we handle and consume our food.
The last component of all this is mental health. And many stressors that come with chronic disease, economic strife, poor living conditions, all of these, not to mention natural disasters. A study by the National Institutes of Health found that the prevalence of serious mental illness doubled in low-income populations that lived through Hurricane Katrina, particularly post-traumatic stress disorder. And these adverse consequences persisted for a year or more. We've talked to a variety of young folks and educators over the past 3 seasons who express fear and doubt over what's to come in the future. For those already suffering, the impact becomes amplified with the perceived loss of control.
You've also got mental health effects among people who have severe baseline mental illness. They die at very high rates during heat waves, possibly medication effects or possibly metabolic abnormalities. But putting those aside, there's another mental health pathway that probably pervades much of our society. And that's exactly what you said. It's the anxiety, depression, despair that come from contemplating an uncertain and scary future. It goes by different names: eco-anxiety, pre-traumatic stress syndrome, solastalgia, which is the distress that comes from watching the degradation of beloved places. It's especially evident in young people, the very same people who are climate activists who are doing so much to move the needle on this issue. More and more, we're seeing young people opting not to have families, not to have children. There's a growing doomer literature suggesting that we've already lost this war and we might as well just give up and prepare for the end.
Quality of life depends a lot on where you live and how cities, towns, and countries handle the impacts of the climate crisis varies dramatically. There's also a disparity in who gets the most attention. In major U.S. cities, the average person of color lives in a place with much hotter temperatures than other residents. These neighborhoods trap smog and escalate poor health conditions. They can also be food deserts where healthy meals are limited. Again, here's Howard Frumpkin.
You know, almost any health outcome you can think of hits the disadvantaged harder than it hits the privileged. That goes for cardiovascular disease and for cancer and for injuries and for difficult child development. Poverty and lack of opportunity and racism all predict bad health outcomes. In the context of climate change, that holds true. So people who are disenfranchised as the result of race or social class or related factors suffer worse from heat waves because of living in hotter parts of the city and not having air conditioning and not having access to resources that would help them be resilient. People who are unfortunate are much more vulnerable to severe weather events, disasters. And we can go down the whole list. There also are other inequities in the way climate change affects people's health. So, for example, the elderly are more susceptible to heat waves. Children who suffer from asthma are more susceptible to wildfire smoke. So medical conditions, age, and other things also can be risk factors to particular climate risks.
Like other social issues, climate disruption is a threat multiplier. It makes a lot of bad things even worse. And those effects occur across the globe. Those without the means to adapt suffer the most. And let's face it, a lot of societies seem to pay more attention to people with status and power. Where are the pretty parks and green spaces, the solar panels, sidewalks, and good transportation? All the new innovations. Many of those things start in more affluent communities in a country. They're in areas with prime real estate. Poverty has declined globally by a large amount, but the share of poor people living in urban areas is rising worldwide. And when a hurricane or heat wave hits, these neighborhoods don't have the infrastructure to protect poorer residents. That said, it seems like we are all ill-prepared across the board for what's to come, no matter where you throw the dart. A good example of this is the 2003 heat wave that hit major metropolitan cities in Europe. It was the hottest summer on record at the time. More than 70,000 people died, by some estimates. It also led to drought and caused a crop shortage. France saw 8 consecutive days with temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and it wasn't much better elsewhere. I brought this up with Ilan Kelman, professor of disasters and health at University College London, and discussed how a city's infrastructure plays a role in the impact of climate disruption on our health.
That's not really the heat wave which concerns me. In a sense, that was a very typical, very usual heat wave. Yeah, it was hot, but not excessive. Every single person who died, died as a result of social inaction, political problems, and appalling management. So Paris was a classic example where most of the fatalities were actually elderly people living alone. And this being August in France, everyone was on holiday, the authorities weren't really paying attention. So those who were isolated had no support mechanisms, no social services, ended up dying. The issue with climate change is not even that this sort of heat wave will become far more normal. It's actually that the heat-humidity combination is going to be beyond human survivability. So even though people died in 2003, if there were cooling centers, if they'd hydrated properly, if they could have simply had air conditioning between the hottest hours of the day, they might have been able to survive at night. What climate change is doing is pushing us, including London and Paris, to the point where without 24/7 artificial cooling, we're dead. And that's what's terrifying. So yeah, the 2003 heat wave, it even buckled the rail lines in places around the UK so that the transportation was disrupted. Climate change is going to push us into temperatures which simply aren't survivable and which the infrastructure has no way of coping with.
What Ilan is referring to is that perfect storm of heat and humidity. We know it well in the southeast of the United States. You might know that effect. You step outside and it feels like You've walked into a sauna. It's uncomfortable, sure, but if you're not used to dealing with it, you can get faint or get sick. That's why you're not supposed to stay in a sauna for more than 20 minutes at the gym.
What really concerns me the most is the fact that we are going to be hitting temperatures which really, since London has been settled, since London became a town or a city, have not experienced. Aside from that, we don't have the infrastructure for it. So we have what's called the London Underground or the London Tube. It's a subway, and some of the lines are not even air conditioned. They are so deep that it heats up so quickly that, in a sense, it may not be possible to step on that tube train in the heat and humidity combinations which we're expecting. The vast majority of domestic and commercial buildings actually don't have very good ventilation, don't have very good air conditioning. We can buy fans, but then the power grid is going to be taxed. And there was already a major blackout in 2003. There are some issues with the electricity supply. And even right now, there are problems with gasoline, with petrol, in terms of getting it around the country and then people panic buying. So even if we do have artificial cooling, if the power goes out, we're in trouble. We're all going to be vulnerable, whether we're at home when it's not cooling down at night, trying to get to work, either walking or in public transport where it's too hot, or just sitting sweltering in the office if they are not air conditioned.
Elon brings up the London Climate Change Partnership as one active resource for creating change. It's basically a conglomeration of various organizations, both public and private, working together to prepare for some of these potential catastrophes. The group identifies areas of the city that are vulnerable to disruption and suggests potential solutions or resilience plans to circumvent disaster. They advise local officials on best policies and help to create incentives and penalties for those who don't comply.
There's a lot which they're trying to do, but often it comes down to lack of resources. London, being a megacity, really has awful air quality at the moment. But the mayor has shown leadership, and the London Climate Change Partnership has assisted in terms of pushing forward low emission zones and ultra low emission zones, which means that to enter it, your vehicle has to have a certain standard of not emitting pollutants, or else you pay. London has long had problems where short, intense bursts actually cause localized flooding. If you get a couple of inches of water into your house or business and you're not ready, you could be out for 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, and incredibly expensive to repair. One of the issues is that the storm sewer system in London comes from the Victorian era. We're talking over 100 years old, built when the population was far, far less. So the London Climate Change Partnership, in conjunction with the Mayor's Office and some of the other authorities for London, are looking at issues like this in terms of trying to improve the storm sewer system, getting properties ready to be flooded, informing owners that these sorts of situations could happen and here's how they deal with it. They are hampered, again, as I mentioned earlier, by lack of resources. Without change, we could see people dying.
Across the pond, there's another interesting case playing out in the town of East Orange, New Jersey. As we've pointed out, access to green space provides not only a recreational resource for a community, but it also cleans the air, cools the temperature, and can have huge impacts on mental health. Think of how lovely it is to jump on the swing in a park if you're a kid, or go for a run after work. Studies show childhood exposure to parks, forests, and other rural lands reduces the risk for developing an array of psychiatric disorders during adolescence and adulthood. These spaces counter chronic diseases and associated symptoms, including anxiety, obesity, and cardiovascular disease, and they benefit the environment by reducing the likelihood of flooding. They provide cooling also, and shade on hot summer days. In East Orange, there's a battle over an historic green space known as Columbian Park. Here, trees and other natural elements are being removed to make way for an artificial turf football and baseball field, and also a rubberized running track. It's meant to withstand flooding, but it's causing a big rift between residents and local officials. Synthetic turf may leak chemicals. It's also shown to increase physical injuries when used for athletic activities. I wanted to hear directly from someone on the ground to understand more about this. Carter Mathis is a professor at Rutgers University and a longtime resident of East Orange. He is actively leading a group of locals who are petitioning the city to change their plans for the park.
The main issue facing my immediate community here in East Orange is an environmental and health issue. Around 2010, 2011, the playground in the park was burnt down mysteriously. A bunch of us here have been advocating for the city to replace it, but for various reasons, they refused. Now, that's only part of the park. The other part of the park includes a basketball court, which has also been dilapidated and in need of repair, a swimming pool, which also needed some repair, and then a big open field, which is lined with a dozen and, 17 or so old trees, big 100-year-old trees. And so it was just an open grass field. The city was beginning to talk about renovations and it solicited ideas from the community. So that was done around 2013, 2015, and nothing really happened. In terms of any type of movement forward on the actual project until the past year or two, we started to see people in the park kind of surveying, workers. So we started to ask questions of them and then of our city council people who said that, the park improvement was going to start, but they also shared that it was going to involve taking down all the trees around the field and replacing the grass with synthetic turf. Many of us in the community began to get active and started circulating a petition to the city in resistance.
Carter's primary concern was the open field. Removing the grass and cutting down trees changed its dynamic and history. Residents would lose the benefits of having more natural filters in the community. He and his neighbors met with city officials who countered that the field would be used for athletics, and synthetic turf is common in that respect. A local football league would play there. But after more discussion, it became clear that the city's intentions were more financially motivated. Artificial foliage requires less maintenance compared to the trees and the grass that had been neglected in recent times. Before long, the trees were bulldozed.
We already lost the trees. And so then we kind of redirected our efforts on trying to keep them from putting down the turf. We presented to the city information about our concerns regarding the turf, part of which was the urban heat island effect. The research around heat islands has been looking at the disparity in climate and temperature between areas where trees have been removed and you have a majority of like concrete or non-organic material, how within even a several block radius, like you can have a difference of up to like 10 or 15 degrees in temperature due to those factors. In fact, that day when they cut down the trees, it was still warm and it felt like the temperature immediately rose when those trees came down. Those people playing on the turf are subject to temperatures that are, 10, 15, even 20 degrees hotter than the air temperature. And then in our case, the surrounding community on the block, all these houses are now having the temperatures around them raised. So greater need for cooling. The trees had also given us a lot of protection from, wind, rain, various elements, and had a great cooling effect for the neighborhood. And now if to compound that, they're going to put down fake grass, which does not, also doesn't really contribute to cooling at all. And in fact, the synthetic turf, it raises the temperature. I have sons who play soccer and play on that, and it's always, 10 to 15 degrees hotter. There's concerns about the PFAs, the chemicals that are in the fake blades of grass, as well as the tire crumb rubber that serves as the infill. That kind of, toxification through runoff and in the drainage, as well as the heating of the turf, releasing of those chemicals in the immediate air on instances when there's play during hot days, so that people playing on the turf or near the turf can actually be subject to the byproduct gases from those chemicals that are in the turf. The injury concerns, as I was outlining, are the increased impact of falls on the harder surface, the ways in which joint injuries can occur as the turf deteriorates.
After meeting with local officials, Carter began appealing to the state's Department of Environmental Protection. His group is looking for any loophole to get their park back, specifically investigating grant requirements for park renovation projects. Perhaps the city muddied the details of their plans. They're also looking through environmental justice bills and guidelines that are specifically targeted to help overburdened communities like East Orange. According to Carter, the neighborhood is at least 90% Black, working-class families living in close proximity to industrial factories and construction projects. As of now, Carter's still actively campaigning for some middle ground in the development of this beloved community center.
East Orange is a complicated place. It's a chocolate city, Black leadership, but there's a kind of respectability politics. The need for this synthetic turf is to essentially make that field space into a kind of more of a recreational complex that will not necessarily be simply for the community anymore. People go out there and play soccer, football, just messing around. Also, a lot of older people had enjoyed, you know, walking their dogs or just walking in around the park underneath the shade of the trees, which are no longer. The field space will likely cease to become the community space that it was before, as it had existed as this kind of natural space. It's one of the only green spaces the community had, you know, in terms of a space that's just natural and that had lots of wildlife, like birds and skunks, raccoons, just all kinds of different, you know, foxes would come through. It was a very peaceful space. And there are some people in the community who I would say, you know, just would find solace in the park, would just be on the older bleachers, just sitting there, you know, underneath a tree. Also, some people who, you know, dealing with mental health issues, finding peace, you know, just being out there in nature.
Activists like Carter don't just seek solutions, they demand solutions. At stake is our physical and mental well-being, not only the land we live on. The Biden administration has launched a variety of initiatives to counter the climate crisis, one of which includes new enforcement measures to protect indoor and outdoor workers from extreme heat through the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. That's a good start. Our workers are some of the most vulnerable to these changing conditions. Last year, Howard Frumkin came up with an even bolder idea, however. Let's create a National Institute of Climate Change and Health. I'll let him tell you more about it.
I worked at the CDC for 5 years at the National Center for Environmental Health, and I love the CDC, but it is not fit for purpose. It's been chronically underfunded for many years. It doesn't have authority. We don't have a national workforce prepared and ready. For a moment, let's compare the military with the public health workforce. We have 2 million or so people in uniform in the military. We don't actually have invasions happening, but we have a lot of preparedness for those invasions, lots of drilling, lots of upgrading of weaponry, lots of training of the pipeline of leaders, officers training, and so on. On the public health side, we have a workforce numbering in the tens of thousands. They are not doing constant drilling and preparedness. We don't have training academies the way the military does. We don't have a pipeline of leadership, but we do have huge threats that are coming home to roost all the time. This concept of a National Institute for Climate Change and Health would be part of the National Institutes of Health.
From Howard's perspective, this new entity would handle both research and implementation of new policies around climate change. work that's currently being divided between the National Institute of Health and the Centers for Disease Control. It would look for health threats, forecast risks, project where diseases might spread and who was in the line of fire. It would test solutions and build infrastructure to support those affected. Essentially, it would revamp healthcare to accommodate for the impacts of the climate crisis. It would also establish a system that supports cleaner energy.
The health sector is almost 20% of the U.S. economy, almost 10% of our carbon footprint, and it's lagging most other sectors of the economy in terms of moving toward decarbonization. We need all sorts of new technologies and techniques and practice styles to be able to decarbonize the health sector. As we decarbonize the rest of the economy, transportation, energy, agriculture, and so on.
There are things that all of us can do to support better health in the face of climate disruption. They aren't as lofty, of course, but they may have great potential for resilience. We talked earlier about food waste, for example. That's something that everyone can work to alleviate. Food in landfills rots and produces methane gas. Methane gas currently contributes to 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions. We can all be more conscious of how much we buy. Make a shopping list. Donate to a community fridge. Compost. There are even companies that help to repurpose leftover food from restaurants so that nothing gets thrown away. This is particularly significant in states like California, where a law going into effect this year actually fines certain businesses if they don't reduce organic waste and donate edible food. If everyone cuts back just a little, conserving food from the harvest all the way to our dinner plates, it could make a huge difference. We might even get a better meal out of it.
You shop frequently and you waste a lot less food, and you're eating fresher food if you eat that way. If you shop frequently, that social connectedness builds a fabric in life that is a very, very pleasant thing. And by the way, social connectedness at the community level is one of the strongest defenses we have against disasters. You can build FEMA up as big as you want, but when disaster strikes, if you and your neighbors are looking out for each other, that's a very strong predictor of resiliency.
Which leads us to one last solution in the move towards climate adaptation, a united stance. Carter and his neighbors are a force. Only together can they save that park. Globally, youth activists are taking the environment onto their backs. They're protesting. They're bringing to light issues. They're unstoppable. This positive action can counter some of the negative mental health consequences of climate disruption. That all being said, the way that we disseminate information makes a huge difference.
I do think social media makes despair contagious in a way that it never was before. But on the flip side, social media also helps to drive activism. When it comes to the damage wrought by climate change, when it comes to the loss of beloved places, when it comes to the loss of biodiversity, those things are already happening. And even if we were to stop emitting carbon tomorrow, they would continue to intensify for some time. I think there's a sense among young people that they won't have the same opportunities for good lives that their parents did. And partly that results from economic forces that would be occurring even if it weren't for climate change. We're not making change as fast as we need to, but there is no evidence at all that the game is up. And if we roll up our sleeves and make the changes we need to, there's a very good chance that we can prevail. Being hopeful is better for people than being hopeless. Being hopeful predicts much better health, mental health and physical health, than giving up hope. Being hopeful predicts action. Despairing predicts inaction. This is a time when we need lots of action to tackle the climate crisis, so there's every reason to propel hope.
Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For information on this episode, please visit our website, progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, at CPRblog, or follow us on Instagram, at Progressive Reform, all one word. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review. It will help us to reach more listeners like you who want to connect the dots on today's most pressing issues. I'd like to thank our guests today, Howard Frumkin, Elin Kelman, and Carter Mathis. as well as our producer, Courtney Garcia, and our assistant producer, Maggie Duane. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.